Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Exodus chapter 10. It goes from chapter 10 through chapter 13, verse 16 of chapter 13. So Exodus chapter 10, the section of bow. Jehovah said to Moses, "Come to Pharaoh, for I have made his heart and the heart of his servants stubborn, so that I can put these signs of mine in his midst, and so that you may relate in the ears of your son and your son's son that I made a mockery of Egypt and my signs that I placed among them, that you may know that I am Jehovah." Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh and said to him, "So said Jehovah, God of the Hebrews, until when will you refuse to be humbled before me? Send out my people that they may serve me. For if you refuse to send forth my people, behold, tomorrow I shall bring a locust swarm into your border. It will cover the surface of the earth so that one will not be able to see the earth, and it will consume the remaining residue that was left to you by the hail. And it will consume all the trees that grow for you from the field. They will fill your houses, the houses of all your servants, and the houses of all of Egypt, such as your fathers and your grandfathers have not seen from the day they came onto the earth until this day." And he turned and left Pharaoh's presence. Now Pharaoh's servants said to him, "How long will this be a snare for us? Send out the men, that they may serve Jehovah their God. Do you not know yet that Egypt is lost?" So Moses and Aaron were returned to Pharaoh, and he said to them, "Go, serve Jehovah your God." Which ones are going? Moses said, "With our youngsters and with our elders shall we go, with our sons and with our daughters, with our flock and with our cattle, shall we go, because of the festival of Jehovah for us." He said to them, "So be Jehovah with you, as I will send you forth with your children. Look, the evil intent is on your faces. Not so. Let the men go now. Serve Jehovah, for that is what you seek." He drove them out from Pharaoh's presence. Jehovah said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt, the locust swarm, and it will ascend upon the land of Egypt and eat all the grass of the land, everything that the hail had left." Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and Jehovah guided an east wind through the land all that day and all the night. It became morning, and the east wind carried the locust swarm. The locust swarm ascended over the entire land of Egypt, and it rested in the entire border of Egypt, very severely. Before it, there was never a locust swarm like it, and after it, there will not be its equal. It covered the surface of the earth, and the land was darkened, and it ate all the grass of the land and all the fruit of the tree that the hail had left over. No greenery remained on the trees or the grass of the field in the entire land of Egypt. Pharaoh hastened to summon Moses and Aaron and said, "I have sinned to Jehovah, your God, and to you. Now please forgive my sin just this time and entreat Jehovah, your God, that he may remove from me only this death." He left Pharaoh and entreated Jehovah. Jehovah turned back a very powerful west wind, and it carried the locust swarm and hurled it toward the Sea of Reeds. Not a single locust remained within the entire border of Egypt. But Jehovah strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not send out the children of Israel. Jehovah said to Moses, "Stretch forth your hand toward the heavens, and there shall be darkness upon the land of Egypt, and the darkness will be tangible." Moses stretched forth his hand toward the heavens, and there was a thick darkness throughout the land of Egypt for a three-day period. No man could see his brother, nor could anyone rise from his place for a three-day period. But for all the children of Israel, there was light in their dwellings. Pharaoh summoned Moses and said to him, "Go, serve Jehovah. Only your flock and cattle shall remain behind. Even your children may go with you. Moses said, even you will place in our hands feast offerings and burnt offerings, and we shall offer them to Jehovah our God. And our livestock as well will go with us. Not a hoof will be left. For from it shall we take to serve Jehovah our God. And we will not know with what we are to serve Jehovah until our arrival there. Jehovah strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not wish to send them out. Pharaoh said to him, go from me. Beware. Do not see my face anymore. For the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, you have spoken correctly. I shall never see your face again. Jehovah said to Moses, one more plague shall I bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. After that, he shall send you forth from here. When he sends forth, it shall be complete. He shall drive you out from here. Please, speak in the ears of the people. Let each man request of his fellow and each woman of her fellow silver vessels and gold vessels. Jehovah granted the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man of Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the eyes of the servants of Pharaoh and the eyes of the people. Moses said, so said Jehovah, at about midnight I shall go out in the midst of Egypt. Every firstborn the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne to the firstborn of the maidservant who is behind the millstone, and all the firstborn of the beast. There shall be a great outcry in the entire land of Egypt, such as there has never been and such as there will never be again. But against all the children of Israel, no dog shall wet his tongue, neither against man nor beast, so that you shall know that Jehovah will have differentiated between Egypt and Israel. Then all these servants of yours will come down to me and bow to me, saying, leave, you and the entire people that follows you. After that, I will leave. And then he left Pharaoh's presence in a burning anger. Jehovah said to Moses, Pharaoh will not heed you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. So Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but Jehovah strengthened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not send out the children of Israel from his land. Jehovah said to Moses and to Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be for you the first of the months of the year. Speak the entire assembly of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, they shall take for themselves each man a lamb or kid for each father's house, a lamb or kid in the household. But if the household will be too small for a lamb or kid, then he and his neighbor who is near his house shall take according to the number of the people. Everyone according to what he eats shall be counted for the lamb or kid. An unblemished lamb or kid, a male, within its first year shall it be for you. From the sheep or goats shall you take it. It shall be yours for examination until the 14th day of this month. The entire congregation of the assembly of Israel shall slaughter it in the afternoon. They shall take some of its blood and place it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they will eat. They shall eat the flesh on it that night, roasted over fire, and matzot, with bitter herbs, shall they eat it. You shall not eat it partially roasted or cooked in water, only roasted over fire, its head, legs, and innards. You shall not leave any of it until morning. Any of it that is left until morning, you shall burn in the fire. So shall you eat this. Your loins will be girded, your shoes on your feet, your staff in your hand. You shall eat it in haste. It is a Pesach offering to Jehovah. I shall go through the land of Egypt on this night, and I shall strike every firstborn in the land of Egypt, from man to beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I shall mete out punishment. I am Jehovah. The blood shall be a sign for you upon the houses where you are. When I shall see the blood, and I shall pass over you, there shall not be a plague of destruction upon you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day shall become a remembrance for you, and you shall celebrate it as a festival for Jehovah, for your generations. As an eternal decree shall you celebrate it. For a seven-day period shall you eat matzot, but on the previous day you shall nullify the leaven from your homes. For anyone who eats leaven, food, that soul shall be cut off from Israel from the first day to the seventh day. On the first day shall be a holy convocation. On the seventh day shall be a holy convocation for you. No work will be done on them except for what must be eaten for any person. Only that may be done for you. You shall safeguard the matzot, for on this very day I will have taken your legions out of the land of Egypt. You shall observe this day for your generations as an eternal decree. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, in the evening shall you eat matzot, until the 21st day of the month in the evening. For 7 days, leaven may not be found in your houses. For anyone who eats leavening, that soul shall be cut off from the assembly of Israel, whether a convert or a native of the land. You shall not eat any leavening. In all your dwellings shall you eat matzot. Moses called the elders of Israel and said to them, draw forth or buy for yourselves one of the flock for your family, the slaughter of the Pesach offering. You shall take a bundle of hyssop and dip it into the blood that is in the basin, and touch the lintel and the two doorposts with some of the blood that is in the basin. And as for you, no man shall leave the entrance of his house until morning. Jehovah will pass through to smite Egypt, and he will see the blood that is on the lintel and the two doorposts. And Jehovah will pass over the entrance. He will not permit the destroyer to enter your homes to smite you. You shall observe this matter as a decree for yourselves and for your children forever. It shall be that when you come into the land that Jehovah will give you, as he has spoken, you shall observe this service. And it shall be that when your children say to you, what is this service to you? You shall say, it is a Pesach feast offering to Jehovah, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but he saved our households. And the people bowed their heads, prostrated themselves. The children of Israel went and did as Jehovah commanded Moses and Aaron. So did they do. It was at midnight that Jehovah smote every firstborn in the land of Egypt, for the firstborn of Pharaoh sitting on his throne, the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, every firstborn animal. Pharaoh rose up at midnight, he and all the servants and all of Egypt, and there was a great outcry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was no corpse. And he called to Moses and Aaron at night and said, rise up, go out from among my people, even you, even the children of Israel, go. Serve Jehovah as you have spoken. Take even your sheep and your cattle as you have spoken, and go and bless me as well. Egypt imposed itself strongly upon the people to hasten to send them out of the land. They said, we are all dying. The people picked up its dough before it could become leavened, their leftovers bound up in their garments upon their shoulders. The children of Israel carried out the word of Moses as they requested from the Egyptians silver vessels, gold vessels, and garments. Jehovah gave the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, and they granted their request. So they emptied Egypt. The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. Also a mixed multitude went up with them, and flock and cattle, very much livestock. They baked the dough that they took out of Egypt into unleavened cakes, for they could not be leavened, for they were driven from Egypt, for they could not delay, nor had they made provisions for themselves. The habitation of the children of Israel, during which they dwelt in Egypt, was 430 years. It was at the end of 430 years, and it was on the very day that all the legions of Jehovah left the land of Egypt. It is a sign of anticipation for Jehovah to take them out of the land of Egypt. This was the night for Jehovah, a protection for all the children of Israel for their generations. Jehovah said to Moses and Aaron, this is the decree of the Pesach offering. No alien person may eat of it. Every slave of a man who was bought with money, you shall circumcise him. Then he may eat of it. A sojourner and a hired laborer may not eat it. In one house shall it be eaten. You shall not remove any of the meat from the house to the outside. You shall not break a bone in it. The entire assembly of Israel shall perform it. When a proselyte sojourns among you, he shall make the Pesach offering for Jehovah, each of his males shall be circumcised, and then he may draw near to perform it. He shall be like the native of the land. No uncircumcised male may eat of it. One law shall there be for the native and the proselyte who lives among you. All children of Israel did as Jehovah had commanded Moses and Aaron. So did they do. It happened that very day Jehovah took the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt in their legions. Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first issue of every womb among the children of Israel, of man and beast, is mine." Moses said to the people, "Remember this day on which you departed from Egypt, from the house of bondage, with for a strong hand Jehovah removed you from here, and therefore chametz may not be eaten. Today you are leaving, in the month of springtime. And it shall come to pass, when Jehovah shall bring you into the land of Canaanites, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, which he swore to your forefathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, you shall perform this service in this month. For a 7-day period shall you eat matzot, and on the 7th day there shall be a festival to Jehovah. Matzot shall be eaten throughout the 7-day period. No chametz may be seen in your possession, nor may leaven be seen in your possession in all your borders. And you shall tell your son on that day, saying, 'It is because of this that Jehovah acted on my behalf when I left Egypt.' And it shall be for you a sign on your arm and a reminder between your eyes, so Jehovah's Torah may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand Jehovah removed you from Egypt. You shall observe this decree at its designated time from year to year. It shall come to pass when Jehovah will bring you to the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and to your forefathers, and he will have given it to you, then you shall set apart every first issue of the womb to Jehovah, and every first issue that is dropped by livestock that belong to you, the males are Jehovah's. Every first issue donkey you shall redeem with a lamb or kid. If you do not redeem it, you shall axe the back of its neck, and you shall redeem every human firstborn among your sons. And it shall be when your son will ask you at some time in the future, 'What is this?' You shall say to him, 'With a strong hand, where Jehovah removed us from Egypt and from the house of bondage. And it happened when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to send us out, Jehovah killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of man, the firstborn of beast. Therefore I offer to Jehovah all male first issue of the womb, and I shall redeem all firstborn of my sons. It shall be a sign upon your arm and an ornament between your eyes, for with a strong hand Jehovah removed us from Egypt.'" Yeah, Exodus chapter 10 through the first two-thirds or so of chapter 13. So Exodus 10 through Exodus 13, verse 16. That was the whole portion that was part of Bo. It's all the whole section. Through 13, verse 16. That was Exodus 10, chapter 10, through chapter 13, verse 16. Okay? Yes, Deborah.
Why do you suppose that the way that they had to burn up all the lamb, and they couldn't do this and they couldn't do that? It had to be burnt.
Had to be burnt.
Well, I was just thinking maybe it was for the something for the last days. And then also, I find it ironic that Pharaoh asked to bless him before he leaves. So.
Right. So the lamb, burning of the lamb, it's an important concept, in particular for those of you who believe in Messiah, a Christian background. That the Messiah is passing away. He doesn't do it again. You don't participate it again and again and again. For the next day, there are no leftovers. So the idea was Messiah's death, he was put in the grave and buried before the sun went down. And you could not extend that to the next day or the day after or make it lengthy. That was the idea behind it for a Christian viewpoint. From a Jewish viewpoint, they don't discuss Messiah at all. It's not part of him at all. It is a desecration of the offering. So in a Jewish viewpoint, means strictly looking at Torah only, there are certain offerings that you will look at Leviticus, we get there again, that are allowed to extend into the second day or even some instances a third day. but most offerings must be consumed that particular day. If the sun goes down and you cannot extend it to the next the sunrise, you must consume it or burn it all the way up. The whole offering is consumed. So the nature of the offerings themselves, ones that are offered to God typically are completely burned up or consumed up. Ones that are, I use the term loosely, the barbecue style, the majority of them must be eaten the day they're offered, but there are certain instances which you could extend it to the second and even up to the third day on certain instances, on certain offerings for the barbecue style, the shalamim offerings, they could be consumed it that way. But generally speaking, most of them must be consumed at the exact day which they are offered. They can't be extended out in length. So in a offering perspective, it's the nature of the offering itself. You must consume it. But in a Christian background, a messianic background, say, well, it's has it with Messiah being put in the grave. He was crucified one moment, not the next day, and then again the day after that, and again after that, you can't extend that process. Yeah, it is finished, which is what we recorded here, which is where Messiah got that concept from. It is complete. As God tells Moses, he'll send you out, it will be complete, finished, possibly finished, which Messiah then restated the exact same phrase that God gave. It is finished. It's complete. So again, Messiah was throwing back the reference to people who could hear him all back to Torah with Moses. It is finished, which were God's words. So he was repeating the same phrase. Yes, Rose.
In this sacrifice, burning up the animal, did they have to take the fur off? Mm-hmm. It sounds like they cooked the whole thing.
You skin it first.
But you didn't take the entrails out.
Right. In this instance, it's a roasted animal. So various offerings have certain requirements on how they're cooked, right? Some of them you can boil in water. Boil a pot or pull a soup or stew, for example. Those are all boiled water versions. But most were not. Most were offered on a roast or burned up in fire. That's the majority of offerings.
And my second question about the circumcision, of who got to eat it.
Right.
I'm thinking that this circumcision is a physical thing here.
Yes.
But in the New Testament, it's circumcision of the heart. So no one can partake of the Passover unless they are committed and baptized to God?
That's an interesting question. We'll discuss it a little bit. The cons of the New Testament circumcision of the heart is not from the New Testament. That's from Jeremiah's instruction. The cons of circumcision of the heart has not relevant to the physical circumcision, meaning a person who is physically circumcised may or may not be circumcised in their heart. That's Jeremiah's instruction. Hey, your physical circumcision does not mean your heart is circumcised. And Jeremiah pointed out, you must have your heart circumcised to make this work. Moses said the same thing.
So in today's market, if a man is not circumcised, but his heart is circumcised, he's still of God?
He may be of God, but he's not a partaker of Passover.
He can't take the Passover.
Right, that's the instructions. The Passover instructions are, you must be physically circumcised.
What do you do?
If you're physically circumcised... Well, hold on. I'm just saying what the law specifically states. The law specifically states, and I don't want to upset anybody, but a physical service is required to partake in Passover. That's a requirement. Now, on top of that, a heart circumcised, by the way of your heart, is also required for partaking of Messiah. Does that make sense? So there are two different things being part here. One is the eating of Passover that we have the Seder, the Seder service, but you have the Torah, explicit instructions. But if your heart is not circumcised, Messiah's offering is meaningless to you. Does that make sense? So both are required to make this functionally work. Yes, Jeff.
And that's what Paul's point is about if you take it in an unworthy manner, not recognizing the body. Mm-hmm. The point is just what the prophet Jeremiah was getting at is that, you know, circumcision itself is nothing unless you first are circumcised in your heart.
Right.
Otherwise, as Paul puts it, you're just mutilating the flesh.
Yeah, it means nothing anymore. Right. So if you want, so an individual male, by the God's instructions, if he wishes to eat of the Passover meal, now whether or not he believes in Messiah or not. That's not relevant to this instruction. He may or may not be Christian, I'm using the term loosely, or messianic. He may be a standard Jewish, for example, standard Judaism, and that their religious belief, it's fine. In order to consume or be part of the Passover meal, they must be circumcised. The males must be. Now, because he can't get rid of that because that would be breaking the Torah, breaking God's law. No, he can't. No.
So today, if a man is uncircumcised,
he is not to eat the Passover meal. Well, being in the kingdom is not, does that do with eating the Passover meal? The kingdom has to do with his relationship with Messiah and God. That's a heart circumcision requirement. But these are different things. Yes, Jeff.
Rose, that's what the point of Acts 15 was. And they're saying, must we be circumcised according to the custom of Moses to be saved? And they said, no, because the nations got in the same way we did.
Right. Hopefully it makes sense. Tammy.
Much of this conversation about the Passover is something of a moot point because those of us who believe in Messiah and consider ourselves messianic, when we do our Passovers, it's not a Passover sacrifice. It is a memorial to the Passover.
Watch,
it's not the same thing.
Right, remember.
So since there's no temple, there's no sacrifice, you know, we can serve lamb if we want, but it's not a Passover sacrifice. Mm-hmm. So we don't, you know, compel people to say, are you circumcised or not? We don't quiz people before they come in the door of our seders whether they're circumcised or not, because what we're offering is not a Passover sacrifice. We're doing memorial. We do seders where we're teaching the children, teaching people about it, but we're not doing a Passover in the strictest sense of the word.
Right. So in this instruction, to consume the Passover service, that's Passover service, you must be circumcised. That's the idea. The exception being, in order to consume the Passover offering that is talking about the whole Passover service, to consume it, the males must be circumcised. Whether you are purchased for money or not, if you're purchased, your owner is, so therefore you must be, and if you're going to eat part of this. If you are a stranger hanging around, a slave, because you can be a slave that's unpurchased. For example, Solomon did that. He enslaved the foreigners, but he didn't buy them, he just enslaved them. They were not partakers of Passover, but they were still enslaved. So they were soldiers, people hanging around. They were not required to partake of or consume it, but if they wanted to, they had to be circumcised. Does that make sense? You could not consume part of the Passover service, man. Now, this Passover meal was done through all the various families. I realize people far distances, I don't know how they did it, but the lambs were offered there at the temple, the temple was built. Were all killed there. That's what was then disseminated around the various families and people groups. Yes, Larry.
It's what we're doing as a practice for Passover.
Oh, yeah. What we do in our modern day, what we do today, there is no temple. There's no official Passover lamb. I don't go out. I don't go and collect a lamb and examine it on the 10th day of the month and then slaughter on the 5th, 14th, the evening of the 14th day of the month. I don't think anybody here does. If you do, great, but that's your business. because the Passover meal, the Passover lamb at this time would have been done at the temple. So the temple service had been done there, for they're the ones who slaughter it. And that's how it is used for your service. The temple being destroyed makes what we do today a memorial, just to remember that it happened. To not forget. That's all really what it is. And that's basically what it is. Right, what's going to happen in the future, something's going to change. We know that much. We're not sure what it all looks like, but something's going to be changing. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, well, you bring up a very interesting point, because, you know, there'll be some say, well, hey, you know, the law was this here, and it changed here, and the change there. With Pesach, that's a very good example, because the first Pesach, it was in Mitzrayim, there in Egypt, in the people's houses, with the blood on the door. But afterward, the memorials were carried out, moved to the tabernacle, then the temple. So is it like, well, is it a different Pesach? No, it's just the instructions were saying, hey, the venue has changed.
Right.
Situation, they're the first Pesach, different from every Pesach thereafter. So just like with Shabbat or other things,
they're all different.
At Shabbat was one particular situation. Once the tabernacle was established in the temple, then changed. Right. It shifted the emphasis.
You went across that a number of times. For example, when King David reassigned the Levites, and I said, okay, those of you who used to take care of the temple, the tent parts and tent pieces as you drifted around and moved around, he fired them all, reassigned them as gatekeepers in the physical temple that was built, the actual physical structure. So he changed the Torah's, now he didn't delete the Torah's instruction, he changed the application. The individuals, this service no longer needed, however, this service over here is. So now you're being shifted from Levites, from this job Levite to this job of Levite. So you as time progressed, circumstances changed. And then, not that the Torah wasn't deleted, it's just the sections were no longer applicable. So you had to apply those individuals, those sections differently. Yes, Katrina.
From the past.
Right.
Okay. I'm just curious if you know what modern Israel does today. I mean, are there any, just a funny question, but do they do any lamb slaughtering for Passover and put it on the doors in Nazareth or what?
So each subsect group has their own philosophies and beliefs. So if you chose to, for example, I'm going to cite two citations. So you can, there's more than two, by the way, there's in the hundreds. But if you wish to participate in the Passover done by the Samaritan groups today, they do a whole lamb, they roast the entire thing, they make a big pit in the ground, put fire in there, put a big old blanket, they throw the lamb in there on a stick and cover it over and let it sit for a couple hours. They all eat that. So that is commonly done today in Israel, on the Samaritan groups. On the other extreme, the Orthodox Jewish groups, they have two different categories, which they do. Most of them will take the lamb and take it and set aside usually 2 weeks or 3 weeks in advance and start examining ahead of time. Now, a couple of years ago, they started the process of slaughtering that lamb about 4 or 5 days early. So instead of waiting the 14th, they would kill them like the 10th or the 11th and dress it, let it hang, do all the various things they have to do with it, the kosher parts, and then they would participate and eat that. Now, they do not classify that as a Passover lamb in the category of the temple use, but they still restrict who was allowed to eat of it. So it was only males alone that could eat that particular lamb. They didn't allow the women to eat it or children, males only. That particular event and that particular subsect of Jewish group, that's a small subset, but they're the most popular, meaning they're most well-known. And then they have other groups that do different things. Because there are just as many people as there are ideas, you can't pinpoint Israel as a whole, as a group, say, well, they all do this. It doesn't work that way. Just like I don't do the same thing as anybody else here does, and vice versa, you all do things differently. There are just as many people as there are opinions. In some cases, there's a few more opinions. But that's just how it all works. So to pinpoint a group, say, well, they do this, or they should do that, or the Orthodox do this, that's an unfair broad brush painting. Does that make sense? Hopefully it makes sense. Any other questions about this section so far? Which blessing? Oh, right, the blessing. If you will notice in the conclusion of the matter with regards to just before the death angel came through, it said Moses and Aaron finished their work. They were done. So Moses and Aaron, they did 9 plagues and 2 signs. Right, with the hand thing, with the leprosy, and the snake thing, plus 9 plagues. They did not perform the 10th plague. They were not part of it at all. That was strictly God. So Moses and Aaron didn't like raise their hand up or let's just stretch out your staff, none of that stuff. They just, they're participants like everybody else. They put the blood on their doorpost. They hung out inside and waited like everybody else was waiting. They were not participants in the 10th plague. That was strictly God alone. So in the case of when Pharaoh, because obviously no man walked into Pharaoh's house and killed his son. Clearly, he died of his own. Yeah, he saw the movie. Yeah. the mist that they have coming through, right? So no man walked in. So, and I don't know what kind of guard system Pharaoh had for his family, but I imagine they were probably fairly decent and stout individuals. They may have died too, for that matter. So no one went in there. So Pharaoh has a full personal realization that this wasn't from like the locusts or an external event, right? Hail's from the outside. The blood is in the river that the Nile that's outside. The frogs are outside. Well, this is not outside. This is inside. This is different. This is inside your personal space. It affected Pharaoh more directly than all the other various plagues. I realize the boils, I'm sure, affected him too, but that's not the same as your son dying. They're just different. That's not the same. Now, I want to point out that in that statement, as Moses gave to Pharaoh, this says not even dog's tongue will wet its tongue. Or how many of you have or know of a neighbor who has dogs? How many people get to walk by stranger wise and the dog doesn't speak?
Well, my dog wants to tear their leg off.
Exactly. Anybody walking by, and think of like large dogs or medium sized dogs, what do? They bark, they yell, they say, hey, there's an intruder or somebody help, I want to get at them. That's what they do, right? I have yet to meet a dog that comes when I'm a stranger to who doesn't look at me suspiciously. Who are you? I don't bark at you. I get to meet one. I'm sure there probably is one. Maybe there's something wrong with him. But most of them are, what is this? You're a stranger to me. So that's a normal dog reaction. But what happens to Israel? Not even a dog barked.
Yeah.
Even at the men, women, or the animals. What do you think the Egyptians noticed? That is dead silence. Not even the animals, the dogs that bark at everything, not even they're going to sit there and actually express, hey, there's a stranger here. And there could be a lot of reasons why. God is the dominant one. The dogs are probably also, however, lost their firstborns, if they're still around. Because the animals, all the animals, beasts, the same thing. They lost their firstborn. They may have been sad. But regardless of that issue, the Israelites received not even the dogs barking at them. Mind you, have a whole smorgasbord of people pack up quickly and gather stuff and run out and take off. That's a lot of activity. You imagine a lot of activity going on. Even things will break sometimes. You carry these 15 jars. I'm tired. The last one, it dropped, crack, shatter. All the various noises of moving, the dogs didn't even bark. So that's very silent. So I imagine the Egyptians noticed that there's not just the dogs, but there's just the strangeness of the entire scenario. And as Pharaoh's servants realized prior to Pharaoh, that they point out, don't you know Egypt is lost? Egypt was done. Now, Egypt is a strange country at that time in history, and that it was very, 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 very long and very, 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 very narrow. So it's like 1,000 miles long and 10 miles wide. Because it exists the entire length of the Nile, and you go too far outside, it's a wasteland. You don't go out there. You're out there on your own. Maybe armies can travel it, but people don't travel out that way. There's no water. So anything along Egypt's life, its existence, was all along the center of the Nile River. That's what they did. Their entire, everything was about that. Because that's the only water source that was effective or valuable. So when an event happens at one end of the country, normally, since it's like almost 1,000 miles long, it takes a lot of time for information to travel from one extreme to the other extreme. Normally, you would think that, because that's typical. But this particular night, and leading up to it with Moses and the Israelites, I imagine the information traveled quickly. Because all the various plagues were going on, whether or not you were near Pharaoh's hometown or whether you were at the furthest southern extreme of Egypt, you still experienced them. And you're still afraid of them, whether you don't understood why, you may not have, but things were going on around you. Pharaoh's not going to go sit there and tell everybody what he did, what's going on with the conversation with Moses. Next to there, write it all down. Here, let's disseminate the messages out so we have the conversation recorded to every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the whole country. He doesn't do that. Nobody would do that. But you may be experiencing it, and you're afraid. Now, the Israelites, however, who are also scattered in their little hovels along the way, also to get messages from Moses saying, pack up, get ready to go. So they would have messengers or somehow information going back and forth. So the entire experience of the darkness, the death of the firstborn, is a very humbling thing around you, in particular if you're Egyptian. So that may be one of the reasons why Pharaoh said, bless me. Bless my country that is now lost. And everybody along the whole Nile River Egypt's not a very, what was, but is not now, a very powerful country at the time. It was diminished a lot. And this is very heavy as the supposed god, Pharaoh himself, supposed to be one of the main gods of Egypt. It wasn't a very good one. Right. Egypt, we'll discuss the Haftor portion regarding that topic hopefully later. Yes, Anne.
So the fact that Pharaoh didn't really get warned about the last plague. Moses left him. I mean, he said, the next day you see me, you'll die, he said to Moses. And then it says, then the Lord said to Moses, I don't know that he warned Pharaoh.
No, he thoroughly warned Pharaoh. Let's see,
right in the beginning that he would
hold
come?
Hold on a minute, it says, thank you. Yeah, 11 verse 4, that's when the Lord speaks to Moses. But then the tail of verse 9, 11 verse says, it was said to Moses, Pharaoh will not heed your wonders, all the Egypt, blah, blah. Moses reported all the wonders of Egypt, Pharaoh said the hearts of Pharaoh, and he did not let Israel go. Moses actually did explain, is it verse 3 or 4? 3 or 4. Favor the favor's eyes. So it says afterward, then Moses leaves. Where is that? Oh, there it is. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So he goes all the way through verse 7 of chapter 11, where he's talking to Pharaoh. He's explaining verse 4 through 7 to Pharaoh. So is he in Pharaoh's presence and telling him what's going to happen? So he's about the God's going to go through firstborn of Egypt. This is verse 5. Every firstborn of Egypt, Egypt shall die. For the firstborn of Pharaoh's throne, the firstborn of the maidservant who's behind the millstone, the firstborn of beasts. So Pharaoh's hearing all these words. Verse 6, there should be a great outcry in the entirety of Egypt, as there's never been, and such as the world never be again. But as all children of Israel, no dog wet its tongue against either man or beast, so that you shall know the Jehovah will have a difference between Egypt and Pharaoh, Egypt and Israel. Verse 8, then all these servants of yours will come down to me and bow to me, saying, leave, you and the entire people follows you, after that I will leave. And he left Pharaoh's presence in burning anger. So he explained verse 4 through verse 8, all within Pharaoh's presence and the hearing of all of his servants. They heard the entire spiel, what's going to happen to them. Now, they did not hear the requirements about the whole blood on the doorpost and how to avoid the problem, but they heard the full warning that was going to be occurring. Mind you, the Torah is not written in chronological order, so don't think that, oh, because this verse says it here, and then that Moses and Aaron leaves his presence, right? That doesn't mean they actually left his presence at that moment in time. It just means now we're going to do a detail of what happened while they were still in their presence. The same thing occurs actually multiple times throughout the Torah, that events are not sequential and chronological, but sequential in what was relevant to the information you needed to know. Does that make sense? Yes, Rose.
Go back to 4:8, it says, it shall come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken unto the voice of the first sign, that right. They will believe the voice of the latter sign.
Right.
So
right.
That's the last one. So it was even foretold before these first five. These five over here.
So all the various warnings, the Egyptians, Pharaoh in particular, and his servants received every relevant warning to them. There were certain instances where they did not receive a warning, that Moses just did it. I think it was the lice, I think, was one of them. And was the darkness one of them? Yeah, there's three of them. Pharaoh did not get an actual hearing of a warning of what this was. But Pharaoh realized who caused it. He wasn't dumb enough to realize, oh no, I wonder how this happened. It's just a shocker. No, it's not a shocker. He called Moses, please get rid of this thing. We see the problem. So even though he didn't receive a warning for all nine necessarily, he still knew who was causing all nine, associating, of course, with Moses and Moses' God. Any comments regarding this topic? Yes, Katrina.
Comment.
Yes.
It's just kind of peculiar how, you know, I find like these abominable countries or whatever still know, like they recognize their God, even though they worship their deities. You know what I mean?
You're, the other nations recognize the God of Israel. Yeah, so that happens for a lot of reasons throughout history, different times. Some of those countries experience strange events, and they cannot understand them, but they somehow are associated with the Israelites or their descendants there from wherever groups or things like that nature. And so they recognize what's going on, that something is strange about this. This is not from our gods. For example, a great example, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar himself with the whole furnace and the three guys, and then there's a fourth guy that says, that's weird. None of my gods have ever done that before. This is strange. They recognize some strange events. King Darius with Daniel in the lion's den, saying this is a strange event. Now, some of those kings also foolishly went up against some of the Israelites and got themselves killed in the process or destroyed. Sennacherib, for example, is a good citation of that that's recorded in the Bible, that his entire army gets wiped out. Is what happened? They were all alive yesterday, and now I got 100,000 people that are sitting there dead corpses. He goes home. So they experience crazy things that shouldn't happen, and they can't explain them. So there's something strange about that particular god. It's weird. Yes, come on.
Well, it's just the same way as we recognize other gods. We recognize Baal. We recognize Allah. We see them. We know that they're there. We don't worship them. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing. And our God is more powerful than all the other gods.
Right.
Which is
yay. Right. Yeah. Do they not? Right. Right, and they have their own texts that tell them about their gods, but the details that is interesting is that their text, if you get an opportunity to ever really study any of them, they are, what's the right word? They are heavily biased, that's the right word, in that when something good happens, most of those various nations record, oh, well, our god of whatever it was did this for us. But when something bad happens, they don't attribute it to their god, or even to their own failures, they think, oh, well, the other god was stronger. So that's simply how they deal with their problems at that particular moment or that month or that day. In the biblical text, it's quite the opposite, that it records even the great people and their screw-ups. So that's not normally recorded in history. Kings don't like people to know about how they screwed up. They record the good things they did in their own eyes. And then they made bad, well, we'll just not write that down. Well, in our Bible said, oh, no, look what King David did. Okay, look what this king and King Josiah and all these people, the strange things they did. And it writes down their good and also all their failures. So biblical text is a strange text in that way, in that it writes down not just man's successes, but also all of man's serious failures. And it writes them down for us to learn from. Most historical texts never record failures. Does that make sense? Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to take these points home here.
Oh, okay.
How many times in our life, when situations arise, we see a warning and we don't heed that warning? And then another sign will come up and our gut tells us, you know, I really should go this way, but my human nature says I'm going this way. And, you know, God says, okay, I warned you, and now, okay, here it comes.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept in that, in that philosophy, that makes general sense for those who believe and follow a God.
Yes.
Not just a God, but a particular one.
No.
So when, for example, Pharaoh did not follow that particular God. Of course, New Testament records that God made Pharaoh and listened up in order to destroy him. So, oh, but that's so unfair. Pharaoh was not going to follow the God of Israel. He was never intending to follow the God of Israel, regardless of what happened to him, clearly. Because these things happened to him, and he wasn't going to follow the God of Israel. So in certain instances, we have scenarios of individuals as tells that the potter creates them in order for destruction, some for honor, some for dishonor. Pharaoh's example, one that was God created, lifted him up in order for dishonor. And as God pointed out, his whole purpose was to demonstrate to the Egyptians and the Israelites, the gods of Egypt don't actually have power. And there's a separation. Do not confuse the gods of Egypt with himself. And that was his goal. And of course, not just his goal for them, but it's been the goal and has been observed for mankind for approaching 3,500 years. We've been seeing the differences. Oh, there was a distinct difference between the God of the Egyptians and the God of Israel. So it's a perpetual instruction that we've all studied for years and years throughout most of our lives about what God, the nature of the two philosophies, the two kinds. Hope that makes sense. All right, so I'm going to wind up not covering the vast majority of my spiel because there's no way I'll have time for that, which is perfectly fine. There's a couple things I want to point out to you, which I pointed out this last time we covered the section of Bo, but it's still worthwhile to recall or to remember. So in the case of, now this, I'm cheating, so I'm doing this on purpose. So that's why I'm cheating. So Matzot is we have that is that matzot is equal of unleavened bread. And bread. That's what the word is. Now it is spelled, which I think God did on purpose. Matzot, it's a mem, a zadi, vavan, and tof, or tet, sorry. So that's the Hebrew word for matzot. Now, I want another word for it. Mitzvah, or mitzvot, actually more accurately, mitzvot. That is the word for commandments. And mitzvot, that's it. So, oh, I messed up my A. Mitzvot, it's commandments plural. So unleavened bread, this is matzot, actually more specifically, is unleavened breads, or it's a plural, they're like the amount of. You may have 100 loaves of matzot, I mean, as opposed to a single loaf of matzah. So it's a single piece. Plural is ot, singular is a, because matzah is a female word. And mitzvot is spelled like this. It's a mem, a zadi, a noon, and a tet. It's the same. So now I realize I told you ahead of time I'm cheating because it's context that defines the word unleavened bread versus commandments. All right? Their words are similar in that the nature of what they come from. Now, mitzvot, the root word, it's of course, is the zavah, zavot. And of course, matzot, the root word is the mem, zadi, and tet. So the root words are different, but the actual spelling is the same. You wouldn't know unless it was context. It's a play on words. Hebrew's playing on the two words of mitzvot and matzot. Commandments and unleavened bread. You will consume unleavened bread during the days of unleavened bread. You consume the matzot. But if you swapped out the word for mitzvot, just for the playing, for toying, you will consume the commandments of God. It's a symbolism. It's a play on words. So matzot and mitzvot, not that they are equal the same. They're not. But they're playing on the spelling of the words, which your mind will understand the relationship between matzot and mitzvot is not that they're identical words, but the symbol is similar. The idea of unleavened bread and following God's commandments, the idea is supposed to be the same or similar idea behind them. Now, I'm doing this on purpose because in the nature of this, some of these phrases in here, you can make the sentence work with either word. Now, you've also heard the term, man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that proceeds the mouth of God. Well, what words came out of the mouth of God? The commandments. So you could use the same phrase, man shall not live by matzot alone. Also, bread actually is leavened bread, but you should live by every mitzvot that comes out of the mouth of God. It's the same word, same phrase. So our Bible, if you were reading Hebrew, is trying to give you an idea of the nature of unleavened bread, not puffed up, not leavened, not filled with itself. Right. is the nature of following the commandments of God. They're associated with each other. They are the same. Now, you will note, yeah, for Passover, not just Passover, but all the various grain offerings, for all the various offerings you give in Leviticus, none of them were ever allowed to have leavening in them. Every offering you gave to God was always had to be unleavened. Now, the exception wasn't really an offering. The exception that did exist was for the day of Shavuot, which was two loaves of leavening. That was one event for a particular purpose. But all the other offerings you give, all the instructions to follow God's ways are always done. You will do unleavened bread. What's the symbol behind that? You will follow God's commandments. That's the idea behind it. So this is how this is supposed to work. So we have this play on of words here, matzot and mitzvot, all over the place on purpose. You shall eat matzot, which means you shall consume matzot or mitzvot, the words of your God. You should be eaten the whole time period. Now, in this sequence of events, we have written here in chapter 13, it talks about the fact God says, I'm having you do all these various things to remember that my words shall be in your mouth. It also says, this bread should be eaten, should be in your mouth. So the bread and the commandments shall be in your mouth. What will you speak of? God's commandments. What will you consume? Bread from God. So what are you going to live by? The commandments of God. Make sense? It's a symbol. The commandments of God is how you live. You think, well, but Jesus, yeah, he followed them too. He did the same thing. Yes, Jeff.
Bread of life.
Bread of life, exactly. That's what it was. That's the nature of it. So we're all playing on words here, but the point is, that was the goal. So if you heard this, even if you couldn't read, as you're supposed to read the Torah, at least the Deuteronomy, at least once every 7 years out loud, the hearing of everybody. If you couldn't read, you would still hear the words in Hebrew, what God's saying. You would understand, oh, bread of unleavened bread, commandments of God, I would associate the two. They're the same. I'd make the two identical in my world, my personal viewpoint. So that's I want to point out to you, because it's the nature of it is valuable, understanding why God does stuff. And it's also valuable to understand the value of the original language, which we lose, unfortunately, in our English translations. But it's nothing evil about it. It's just funny that I find it comical to do so. So let's get, that's one thing I want to talk. I want to jump the Hof Torah real quick, but I can't quite get there just yet. There's one thing I want to point out to you. Let's see here. So in chapter 12, verse 12, it points out that God is going to be doing these tasks, this last particular plague against the man and livestock, and of course all the gods of Egypt. Now, I want to point out this nature, because we always think of, oh well, you know, Egypt's gods aren't really gods, right? They're idols, or they're stone, or they're wood, or they're gold, or whatever. They're not really gods. Okay, yes and no. Right, they're not gods in the form of God, but there are angels over Egypt. Just there are angels over every country. There are beings that rule that we don't necessarily see. So in this nature which God's doing, the phrase he uses, of course, he does the singular God of Egypt, the Elohe, not the Elohim. The God's focusing on the particular angel over Egypt. The being that is over that particular country, he wants to crush that one. So it tells us that God's acknowledging, though he is God of all, there are still spirits that are out there. They still have their many little powers they can control and do things with. And God, of course, crushes this one of Egypt, which is one of the reasons why the firstborn. That was God's explanation. That's how he's doing it. Now, I use the term, it's written singular in Hebrew, because to be fair, the phrase before it says all. So you could argue whether it's singular or plural. It doesn't really matter. The point is that God is acknowledging there's still a being, an Elohe, over Egypt he's going to crush. Now, the last thing I want to point out to this Torah portion, we jump to our New Testament, or sorry, our half Torah portion, is that the last phrase here is that when God decides, when he starts out this section in chapter 10, he's doing something that we don't usually associate with our God, but he does this anyway. This is the very first, early on. It says chapter 10, verse 2. It says, chapter 10, verse 2, it says, you may relate the coming events, that is, regarding, in particular, the locusts. In the east, your son and your son's son, I made a mockery of Egypt. My sin place among them, all as you may know that I am Jehovah. So we don't usually associate God as making fun of someone, but that mockery, that word mockery, means to cruelly abuse someone for fun. That's what the word means, and the Hebrew word means, what phrase means. So the nature of these locusts, what's God telling Moses? I'm going to cruelly abuse the Egyptians for the fun of it. Wow, what kind of God is that? Well, think about what were the Egyptians doing to the Israelites? Cruelly abusing them for the fun of it, because they could. So what's God telling back to him? I'm going to dish back to you what you did to my people. What's that phrase? You cast your bread on many waters, it comes back to you. The parable or proverb off the top of my head. But what you sow, you will reap. The same principle. What you give, you will receive. You're going to bring back what you give. So God, we don't usually associate him as being cruelly and humorous to injure someone, but in reality, he's dishing back what they chose to give. Yeah, I don't use the term karma. That's a whole different religious concept, but. So then the nature is still there. The nature of our God does not forget what people do. Yes.
I have a question. Yes. Something that you said a moment ago, Daniel, so I'm afraid I might take us back a subject a bit. But so Christian theology teaches that the gods of other religions are actually idols and false and imaginary.
Right.
And you had just said that those are actually angels. So
there are some instances, yes.
Okay, so what I'm wondering, so we know that, you know, Satan is going across the earth and trying to distract us, right?
Yep.
And so we also know that there's fallen angels. And I've never made this connection before. So if I think of like the god of Hindu, Shiva, right? Mm-hmm. So perhaps there's actually an angel, Shiva, who has spoken to the people just as God the Creator does.
So it's an interesting concept, yeah. So in this example, which the citation, to be fair, Hindu has like thousands of gods. I don't remember all of them, so forgive me. They have three dominant ones, and then they have the three women. I can't remember their names. Anyway, it's strange. Yeah, all the different gods they've got. So I've forgotten them. I've studied them 20 years ago, and I don't remember. Anyway, so in the nature of each individual, so a false prophet, for example, is one who, in biblical definition, is one who receives a message, either they create from their own head, or something else gave it to them, whether it be God or some other demon or whatever, and they say, hey, this is what I've learned, whatever it may be. So that individual may be worshiping or following that particular deity, that particular being, that spirit, whether the spirit is from God or from something else. They're still following it. So an individual, as God points out, you would test all spirits. I don't know who they are. Test them first. Find out what's talking to you because you don't necessarily know. So if you don't necessarily know, you don't know which one it is. Now, in the nature of, which we have in Ezekiel, which records the concept of this, so of course, obviously, the most common book of Daniel records the same idea, that there are principalities, the nature of spirits of nations or above nations. Now, not above the world, but above individual nations or regions. So we have this idea that spirits do exist, and some of them are more influential, nature of a country, potentially, or something more specific of a single individual. We have the idea of possession of somebody. Oh, they're demon-possessed, for example. A very small or lowly individual with that category. So we have these various ideas or concepts given to us from the Bible, from the Torah as well, that we have the ideas that there are spirits that are not of God, but are still out there doing stuff. Then, well, why doesn't God just kill them all off? Well, He will. That's just later. He's got a purpose for them. And we, of course, had the idea from Ezekiel about the whole the head of Magog or whatever, that phrase there, right? That we have that said that he's going to pull them out as a fish hook, and he uses Hasatan as the fish hook, as the bait. So God's still using those evil individuals to accomplish tasks. Whether they want to, doesn't really matter. He still manipulates situations to they end up doing what he wants them to do. Whether they consciously do so or they just, their own hatred makes them do that, I don't really know. Because the way that, I can't think of the verse off the top of my head. It'll probably come back to me later. About Satan's idea to exalt himself above the throne of heaven. Some of you probably find that. To get his throne in heaven, make himself high. That's his goal. I think it is Isaiah. I remember the top of the, exactly. So that's Satan's goal. Well, that may be his goal, but God's still using him in other tasks. Because the word Satan just means the adversary, one who is against. So I can have an adversary, or I can be an adversary against somebody else. Now, I use this term on purpose because everything physical has a spiritual counterpart. There are humans God uses that we think are evil individuals, but yet they do massive things that are just as corrupt, but God says, yeah, I sent him. What? Yeah, and God says, I sent him. That was my intent. Nebuchadnezzar is a great example. I sent him to slaughter everybody.
Dangerous.
It is very
dangerous.
Because
we're not recognizing the actual power
that's still there.
Lowercase God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those other deities, those other deities, there is an association with them. And that spirit may or may not be in there. It's not. It's obvious it's a rock. But the spirit may not be associated with the individual right there in that moment in time. But the idea behind them and message that spirit may give to others, individuals, they believe they're following whatever God they're supposed to be following. They think that, which is too bad, but it's still true. The nature of idols like rocks and stones and things like that, the Bible talks about those in a different category than actual the spirit itself that's around. So they talk about those items as, well, they have eyes, but they can't see and you can. So they have nose, but they can't smell, but you can. Why is it not worshiping you? You're greater than it is. Because you can do all those things and it can't. It's just a rock. So it was in the idol of that concept, it's obvious because I am greater than it because I can do all the things that it can't do. So it should be worshiping me as opposed to be worshiping something that is lesser than I am. Thank you. Isaiah 14:12. So, you read it out loud. Why not? That's fine.
How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which thou didst weaken the nations? For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, and I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell to the sides of the pit.
Amen. So we have an example of that. That's a great citation. Thank you for finding that, Rose. There's a lot of personals. Every demon has its own desire to be in charge of whatever it's in charge of.
So you're saying the demons are in the rocks and the wood?
No. There's no spirit inside of a rock or a piece of wood or nothing. That's an inanimate object. I'm referring to a spirit that is hanging around that's associated with a particular religious belief. So, for example, a spirit may hang around, her citation was the Hindu religion. There may be actually multiple. They have a lot of gods there. And that is associated with the Hindu religion, and that can tell as many lies as it wants and can mislead an entire peoples all it wants, and God allows that spirit to do so. Those people may make rocks and cut them in this way or make that's what the people are making, but it's the spirit behind the religion itself that is still a real thing. That God is intent or goal is to destroy. Does that make sense?
We can open a door and allow a spirit in, like with telling your fortune or you know, the things of this
spirits,
world.
Right.
You got to be careful not to open those doors.
Right. Yeah. I'll, the fortune teller. Yes, Larry.
So this subject is covered pretty well in Daniel.
Yes, it is.
Although the spirits that he was talking about seem to be on God's side, because he was going to help the Michael, the mighty archangel.
Right.
He said, "I'm going to have to go get help from this other."
Yeah, to angel. Assist in my battles or to get me through.
Those are spirits that are over nations.
Right. So you have these hierarchy. I don't know how it works. I don't really study that. I know there's a lot of theories, probably you crazy ones, but and I don't really care to study it. But the nature of how those various religions, I personally believe various religions do actually have a spirit associated with them. Not the peon, I made it up, humanist, whatever you think of your top of your head. But I mean, like the significant ones are around that seem to propagate out and have strange concepts and strange practices. I personally believe there's probably a spirit that has lied that individual or those individuals along throughout years and has controlled that group of people. That's my opinion. I have the opinion for a variety of reasons. For the things I've read about, said, holy cow, like that's crazy, but it makes sense. So there are crazy things out there. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, which is why the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 6, 11, and 12 talks about when put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places.
Yeah. It's Hopefully I answered your question best I could, Rachel. Yes, Larry.
The firstborn of Egypt and how they belong to him too.
Yeah. Okay, so I won't be able to get to any of the stuff I want to talk about today. That's okay. God decides, right? That's how it works. So God in chapter 13 of Exodus, the first part of it is, I think, 12 as well. Just 13. I'll double check that. I think it's 12 as well. He starts discussing the nature of setting people aside. Chapter 13. So the nature of God's course, he says, issue every will among the children of Israel. So God, unlike a war, which group A fights group B, and one wins, one loses. A bunch of people die, and they fought, and they, swords or guns, whatever they used, one group wins, one group, that's men killing men. You are subject to time and chance. The bullet may pass past you or go through you. You know, who knows how accurate. Maybe you bent over and ducked and the bullet passed or the sword missed. Time and chance happens. That's the nature of one person killing another person. That's how wars work. Now, when you're dealing with God, however, can you dodge it?
Yes.
How do you dodge? God says, you're dead. For a time, you can delay it. Yeah, 15. Can you delay it? But can you dodge the bullet, so to speak?
No.
Not really. Not really.
There's a point.
Everybody dies at least one time. So in the case of Egypt, when God killed the firstborn, now we don't know whether he had an age limit. Doesn't appear to. He killed them from, I assume, from even the old to the young. I don't think there was an age maximum. It says throughout the land of Egypt. So I assume it's all of Egypt. I don't know about the surrounding nations, but all of Egypt. Each individual person, me, you, anybody else, all of us technically belong to God. There are no exceptions. All men, all creation, God creates all things. So everything belongs to him, whether they acknowledge it or does not acknowledge it. It makes no difference, right? So if I belong to God, if I choose not to follow him or ignore him completely as if he does not exist, that is not his fault. That's my fault, right? Now, if all things belong to him, that includes all the Egyptians. They belong to him just as much as all the Israelites do. There's no difference on who owns them. They're the same. Now, they may respond to him differently, but he still owns them both. They're still his children. So if God's going to come in and free one group by slaughtering, by his own hand, another group, you're trading them out. Is God thrilled about having to kill a bunch of people who are, for lack of a better word, innocent.
No.
No.
Right. Life and death, I wouldn't.
You would choose. Right. That's the goal. Exactly. He gave us two ways to live.
Yes.
Now, all the firstborn of Egypt, let's give the little kids who have no power to do anything, to the grown adults or even the animals. All of them belong to God, but God's making a purchase price. He is, I'm going to kill, I'm going to pay with these of my children's lives. I'm going to slaughter these children's lives in order to save these children's lives, to get them free. Now, these other children, the Israelites, they're not doomed to die. They're doomed in oppression. Now, many of them do die, but it's an oppression that he's trying to release them from oppression. So God is killing one child, one of his children, in order to save another child. That's a hard decision for any parent to make, is it not? Would you make that decision so easily? No, Moses would not. How would I choose to kill one child who is innocent, meaning the firstborn, little kids, they don't have power to say, oh, we should set the Israelites free, none of that stuff. This one's innocent. I'm going to kill this one in order to let this one live and free.
That is a plan.
He does have a plan, but God is the one who's doing it. So God is the one who's making the purchase price. It's a hard decision to make, because no parent would ever want to make the choice. But as a result, however, God said, since I made this payment of my children, I now own you, Israel. I own your firstborn. They belong to me. That's what God states in chapter 13. So I'm making this payment on killing this firstborn Set. And then this other firstborn Set, now I own. It is mine. You will always acknowledge it being mine. It's a hard decision to make, that God, who has the power of life and death, is the only one who can make those decisions. And it wasn't by sword, but rather by his own hand who did it. So he could have sent a plague, for example, if he wished to kill a lot of people. He does that at different times. He could have sent an army and men killed them. He didn't. He himself, it was his own hand who did it. So he says, I purchased them for myself, as his record. Therefore, I did it myself. I did it, so it's mine. And that's an important thing to understand. So when you have Egyptian, the firstborn, dead, now a lot of people have died in Egypt as well for various things, that is a major hit on Egypt. That's a huge impact on the culture, the nature of the people, the country itself, the population. And all those children, they would have had children too, had they grown up. Well, she was already out. Hagar was already out. But all those children who are now dead in Egypt, he didn't just kill their children. He killed their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. The 30 or 40 generations later are all dead now too, because they didn't have the kids they would have normally had. So it's a whole generation of not just once, but actually it's a consecutive thing that impacted for thousands of years those who are now dead by the hand of God. So as a result, the Israelites that he purchased out of Egypt, their consecutive generations for thousands of years, he says, I own them too still, as payment for the generations that are missing out of the Egyptians. So I did this one event to get you both separated out, but the subsequent generations to come for the next couple thousand years, I'm going to maintain my ownership of the firstborn of Israel, and as payment for the missing firstborn of the Egyptians. So it's a continual process to never forget. Much like the Passover, we do memorial, the same principle, to remember that this is a perpetual thing that God did. He didn't send an army. He sent his own hand who did the work. It's a hard choice to make, a hard purchase price. Now, at the same time, I want to point this out to you because I'll end with this since I'm out of time anyway. The same time, when the Egyptian firstborn, when they died, now it's predicted to Messiah's death, right? When the firstborn of Israel, or the firstborn of Egypt died, they paid the price, but did they own the Israelites anymore? No. So Messiah died, does he now own us anymore? Ah, wait a minute. Who owns us? Who paid that price? God owns us. God's the one who did, because Messiah said, take this from me, if it is your will, because I don't want to go through this. And God said, yeah, I get it. Guess what? Start walking forward. This, you're going to go through it anyway. So even though the firstborn of Egypt paid the price, Egypt itself does not own Israel, because God is the one who actually paid the real price. He's the one who actually killed, it's his hand who killed them. They're the ones who died, but his hand paid it. So in Messiah's case, the firstborn dies, even though he's the one who passed away, he's the one who was killed, it was God's hand that made it happen. So the same process is still repeated yet again. So God purchased Israel out of Egypt. The firstborn in particular was a process he purchased, and repeated, he purchased again, God purchased again through the death of his son the same way. The son doesn't own us. He even says to himself, hey, God is owns you. This is the payment to God. The father owns us all. He's the father of all. We'll all be sons of God, as Messiah's words. So God is one who owns us, even though Messiah paid the price. And God owns the Israelites, just firstborn, just as even though the Egyptian firstborn paid the price. So the actual payment money, the death, isn't necessarily the owner. The person who paid it is the owner. If I pay you a dollar for something, the dollar doesn't own the object, I do. I just use the dollar to pay it. So the firstborn Egyptian, all the subsequent generations, God's using that as the payment that he owns. So Messiah's firstborn, he dies. God used Messiah as a payment, but he's the one who owns. Does that make sense? Yeah. Hopefully it makes sense. Yeah. I don't have time to talk about the Haftorah, which I thought was really fascinating today, but that's okay. Yes, Larry.
Just one more thing I would add to that.
Go ahead.
He can also fix it through resurrection. So it's not unfair.
Right. It's not unfair. Keep in mind that death is a temporary state of being. It's not a permanent thing. Well, God can make it permanent, but it doesn't have to be permanent. You can choose not to be permanent. God can undo it at any point in time when he says, and of course he said he will. Now, he will not undo the subsequent generations that don't exist, their process, because they never existed. But the ones who actually died, he can undo anything, be it resurrection. He has a process, and of course he said he would do so. So we trust that those innocent individuals in Egypt, they died, but they can be pulled back up again.
It's only the flesh that dies. The spirit goes back to God,
says
in Corinthians.
Right. So we just don't know when. Right.
Right. The spirit goes back to God.
So, and we also have individuals who were physically resurrected. Lazarus, for example. So God can choose as he wishes to do things. He can do anything. There's no limitations.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.